From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, visitors from afar. Oh, you know what that's all about. Here's what's happening. Sadness, tragedy. U.S. Navy and Marine Corps divers have found some human remains inside sections of a U.S. guided missile destroyer that collided with a merchant vessel near Singapore. It's a very sad story there. Another commander has been relieved of his duties. 10 sailors were lost in that mishap. Captain Kelly Sweeney, of course, with us. Kelly, very sad, but again, that's two disasters in a row. What's going on here with our ships?
Well, George, you're right. There's two disasters in a row, and there in the last year, there have been four major collisions of naval vessels with merchant or fishing ships, fishing vessels out on the high seas. I think personally, George, from my perspective, the U.S. Navy, the officers and crew on there have the best tactical expertise in the world. But for many of us for years have noticed that the Navy has stepped down the seamanship aspects of their training. And I think they need to increase that expertise so they're as good technically as they are tactically. In this case here, with the McCain, the Allnick MC, I have reviewed the AIS data from that vessel just before they collided with the McCain. And it's evident to me that the McCain was crossing the traffic lane.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, according to Rule 10 of the International Rules of the Road, it was their responsibility to avoid any oncoming traffic, and they didn't.
Kelly, I am getting a lot of emails from computer experts who believe that our ships may be hacked. Now, number one, is that possible? Number two, if they are, is somebody, you know, playing around with the controls and the guidance?
Well, George, as far as hacking ships, I think personally, I have actually written an article about that in my Professional Mariner magazine column. And I believe certainly that a cyber attack, because modern ships, naval and merchant, rely so heavily on computers, that I believe that's a very real problem. However, I also believe that they need to have the seamanship expertise. They need to be able to navigate and handle their ships as well as they do the tactical side of their job. And I think the Navy needs to step up their training. For example, a few years ago, the Naval Academy was soundly criticized for not requiring the graduates of the school to have the ability to navigate by the sun or the stars, something that every ocean-going merchant marine officer worldwide must be able to do. They have to prove competence in. Luckily, I think they've eased that loosening up a little bit, but that's an indication. I think they need to tighten up. But to go back to your original question, I think a cyber attack is a possibility. No question.
That's dangerous. Kelly, thank you so much. And again, our deepest condolences to the families of those 10 sailors. My gosh. Johnson & Johnson has been ordered to pay $417 million to a woman who says she developed ovarian cancer after using products such as baby powder. The California jury's decision marks the largest award yet and a string of lawsuits that claim that the firm did not adequately warn about cancer risks from talcum powder-based products. A spokeswoman for Johnson & Johnson defended the product's safety. The firm plans to appeal, as it has in previous cases. Well, as Google has been recording you without your knowledge, has that been happening? The technology giant has effectively turned millions of its users, they say, the smartphones into listening devices that can capture intimate conversations even when they are not in the room. Lauren Weinstein, the expert on the internet, and we will make this disclaimer, he has worked as a consultant for Google before. Correct, Lauren?
That is true, several years ago.
All right, this situation here, secretly recording you through your mobile device. What is that?
You know, I had to dig down to find the source story on this, and what I actually found was a very alarmist, very badly confused, very clickbaity story that seems to be just they're making an alarmist story here out of the basic functionality of Google Assistant and Google Now and Google Home. These are these systems where you can say, okay, Google, or hey, Google, if you have a Google Home, and then ask it a question or give it a command, and it does it. And the reason there's no risk here like what they're talking about is, A, you have to say those things before any information is even sent up to Google. Otherwise, it's just being locally processed on the phone or on the Google Home device. When you say those phrases, they're called the hot words, there's an indication that it's been recognized always. The Google Home flashes lights, the phone will beep, and even then, when it starts to listen and sends something up the line, it only listens long enough to see if there's a query or a command, and then it stops listening. That's all there is. There just isn't anything else there. Above and beyond all of that, if you're ever curious as to what Google has recorded when you have commanded it to listen to you that way, you can log into Google. You can go to google.com/myactivity. That's one word, myactivity. And there's a section there where you can see exactly what it has in words. And you can even play the recordings. You can see how they were interpreted. You can delete them. You have complete control over it. So it's not like there's anything mysterious going on here. It's just doing what you want it to do. It's trying to learn how to understand speech better. There's no secret recording going on. And if you have any questions about it, go to google.com/myactivity and look at the log, and you can see what's there, and you can delete anything you want.
Thanks for putting that into perspective, Lauren. Really appreciate it. Ford Motor Company is exploring a new joint venture that will build electric cars where? China, potentially expanding its footprint there in the world's largest auto market. What else is going on with the economy these days? Let's check in with Michael Shedlock. Mish, what's going on these days?
Hey, two key stories there. It's not only Ford. GM is doing the same thing. They're building a car that would cost $5,000. Fully electric car.
That's
in
it?
China. GM, $5,000. That's actually $5,000 with taking off government subsidies. It would really be more like $17,000. So the government's really heavily subsidizing these things. But I wrote about this on my blog, and I'm sitting there, is this really going to do anything about emissions? Because China wants to be energy independent. And one of the ways it does that is by coal. So if they're going to use coal to produce the electricity to power these batteries, I think we're at a net loss here. So we need to step back and say, does this push towards electric cars really make any sense? Now, they're going to use natural gas. I think that's fine. People are worried about carbon dioxide. I personally am not. I think the diesel cars coming out of Germany that have been rigged and everyone knows about now, but those nitric oxides, that's a far worse pollutant. So anyway, we'll see. They're going to sort this out. Whether we like it or not, electric cars are coming.
You got
it. I can switch the subject a second. Did you see the eclipse? I drove down.
Oh, it was gorgeous.
Gorgeous. Coming 6 hours to get down there, George. 10 hours to get back. I talked to people. It took 14 hours to get back, the same distance that I went. Some people never made it. The lines at the gas stations, 30 minutes out, women stacked up out the door just to get the
use. You went to, did you go to Carbondale, Illinois?
I went to Gorville, Illinois, actually. That's right down there in that same area. And I stayed in Paducah, which was about Paducah, Kentucky, about 40 minutes away from the site that I watched the eclipse from. Beautiful site, Ferncliff State Park. $400 a night for a best
western. But I tell you what, you saw something, Mish, that could be once in a lifetime, almost, for a lot of people. Thanks. And talking about darkening the skies, tremendous amounts of soot lofted into the air from global wildfires following that massive asteroid strike 66 million years ago that killed off the dinosaurs plunged Earth into darkness for nearly 2 years, according to new researchers. 2 years of darkness. Up next, all this talk about Russia hacking into our elections? What does that all mean? In a moment, Bev Harris from Black Box Voting joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Bev Harris with us. Bev is the founder of blackboxvoting.org. That's an investigative reporting and public education organization that she founded back in 2003. She has exposed problems with electronic voting. She's been featured in the Emmy-nominated HBO documentary Hacking Democracy. Her book is Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. And, of course, we turn to Bev quite a lot with all these kinds of gizmos and technology that's out there. Bev, welcome back. Good to have you.
Well, yes. This year's been pretty active considering it's not an election year.
I know it really is. I want you to kind of set the tone for us about all this talk and rhetoric about Russia hacking into our elections. Exactly what do they mean? Because I'm not sure they know what they mean.
Yeah, you phrased it exactly right. Now, I pulled the declassified version of the official report from the intelligence agencies and read it very carefully. And while they do say what they mean, it's a bunch of puffery for the most part. For example, they say, well, it included the following, and they have these different categories. One, writing negative articles about Clinton and favorable about Trump in their media. Now, that is not hacking an election.
That's not hacking.
Okay. The next one was having a bunch of social media bots out there. Again, that's kind of like advertising and kind of like media. Both our candidates did that, provably, and everybody knows it. You know, in fact, I found a site for writers when I was looking at, you know, how much gigs pay nowadays. And this was about 2015, shortly before Hillary kicked off her big social media thing. And it was advertising for writers to act as stand-ins to do basically social media bots. So that isn't hacking either. So they had two more categories, actually maybe three more categories. But the next one was hacking or was leaking. We're not quite sure which. The next category was the emails from the DNC and from John Podesta, who was in Hillary's campaign, which were hacked or leaked. It never really makes a convincing case that they were hacked versus leaked. Leaked meaning, you know, some disgruntled staffer downloads them to a USB drive and slips them to somebody. And the other thing is, that's not hacking an election either. It's maybe trying to influence an election, but basically a political party and a campaign. When you say hacking an election, you get the idea that it was affecting a specific, you know, controlling the vote count.
Mm-hmm.
You're not controlling the vote count, you may be influencing it. So the next one is a significant concern, but then they omitted something. The next one is they have proved that there were multiple attempts in various states, successful attempts to penetrate the voter registration database, which is the list of all voters and their history. But the omission there is it wasn't just the Russians, it was also the Turks and quite a few other. So, you know, okay, that's good, but it needs to be put in context. You know, how many different places and entities did it? Did any of our own political parties do it too? When questioned at more detail, they said, well, we didn't say the Russians were the only ones. But that's a big deal. That's
sure.
A major point. And then the last one is really a concern to me, but apparently not to them. They said there was no evidence they hacked the counting of the vote in the voting machines. But when questioned further, they said they didn't do any auditing or ever check.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this sort of muddle, which is collectively referred to as hacking the election. The other thing that bothers me about this story is the way it's reported, where you're sort of shamed if you don't immediately, if you ask for more details or ask for evidence. One of the things that jumped out at me in the report, they reported that all 17, there's not even 17, but 17 different national intelligence agencies all agreed that the Russians did it. And then Trump came out later and said it wasn't 17, it was 3 or 4. Well, actually, it was 2.
2.
And of the 2, one was an appointee of the previous administration. And there was a third one the Department of Homeland Security that said maybe. Now, that's 2.5 at best. That's not 17. So when you see that kind of drumbeat happening where the media is just repeating the same phrases over and over, in addition to whatever the actual story is, there's an agenda going on. And you got to kind of tune into what that might be. I don't know what it is, but it's to me, it reduces the credibility of the whole deal.
Sure does. And you know, Bev, I'm more concerned about hackers from within than from the outside.
Exactly. That's the other thing. Because, you know, in banking, 65% of all thefts from banks are from insiders. They're not from bank robbers wearing masks, charging in the door, or sneaking in through hacking. So the people historically who tend to go after elections and succeed with it are locals a lot of times, but they're people with inside access.
Now, the machines are hackable, though. We know that,
yeah.
Right?
Oh,
you've
yeah.
been saying that for years on this program.
Yeah. You know, and recently they had a huge convention in Las Vegas called DEF CON, and there was, I don't even know how many. It was
like a hacker's show, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness. It's actually quite a spectacle just because if you visualize seeing 20,000 Mr. Robots in one casino, it's very strange, a little surreal. But they had a hacker's village for voting machines. And they got a whole bunch of different voting machines that are actually in use in the United States and let everybody have at them. And it took about 3 minutes. Every single machine succumbed right away to people who had never seen it ever before in their life, which I didn't even actually attend the Hacker's Village because I already knew, because I'm not a computer expert, but even I can do it.
Well, you're pretty good, though.
Well, fortunately, I do interview a lot of them, so I sort of know how to go at it. But that's the other thing, is there's like more than 100 ways to get it, you know, to do it. So it's not even like just finding one method and securing that hole really does it, because there's so many different ways that work. And yeah, they found that these things were really porous. And you know, here it is. I started doing this, writing about this in 2002, actually, and the same stuff is being used.
Well, and one of the concerns, too, Bev, I think one of the major concerns, not just the hacking, but all these illegal names of voters or people who voted, dead people who vote. I mean, that's got to be astronomical.
You know, and I'm also so glad you brought that up. You know, there's a very controversial commission now called the Voter Fraud Commission. They say Trump put it together, but I think it was more of a Republican Party thing that was sort of like put under his mantle, because he wanted them to also look at the voting machines, and they said, no, 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 we don't want to do that. We only want to look at the lists. So that sort of smacks mm-hmm. of a little politicism. But I think there's something there. I don't think it's exactly what they're looking for. I think what it is technologically, using the databases, you can stuff the vote using the names of voters who are dead or who rarely vote. You simply take you get their signature out of the database, and because it's all stored as an image file in the database, and you get the names of the voters who don't vote very often. And if you get all those names, it's millions and millions, and some of them are going to not be voting because they're dead. So that's how the dead people creep into that list. But when you see, and there is, in every election, we see that dead people have voted, even though they couldn't have. When you see that, I believe that's actually a symptom of a much bigger problem, and that is the problem that they're harvesting names of infrequent voters mm-hmm. and happen to have a few dead people in there.
And, you know, historically, it's been a problem in cities, on citywide votes, for years and years.
Absolutely.
So on a national basis, it's got to be huge.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, the implication is that there's these busloads of people who come in and vote without permission or whatever. Not really. It's all virtual. It's just done electronically. So you don't need to go and hire, you know, 3 million warm bodies to show up and pretend there's someone else. That's electronic, and it's simply you take a field out of a database, you export a certain set, and then you implement voting on behalf of that set electronically.
Bev, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and chat more. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with you. Bev Harris with us from Black Box Voting. Her website, blackboxvoting.org, is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. In the Cave in St. Louis. Hey, by the way, don't forget to participate in our weekly trivia contest with new clues every day, Monday through Friday. And every time you get that clue correct, you're in the old hopper for a $500 weekly prize. So take advantage of it every day. Go to coasttocoastam.com and participate in the trivia contest and have some fun doing it. Okay, welcome back. Bev Harris with us from Black Box Voting. Bev, the state of Oregon, for example, is now doing automatic registering for people for voting. It's called universal registration, which, of course, you know about. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, you know, if you do all absentee voting, which is the other thing the state of Oregon does, what it does is it creates kind of a slush fund of names. You know, I mentioned before that you can harvest the names of people who rarely vote. Well, if you want to find a lot of people who rarely vote, it's probably that whole pool of people who never have registered in their life and suddenly just got registered automatically by the state of Oregon. And they may not even know they're registered. You know, you don't, they say you get more people to vote by making it easier. You don't ever get to 100% because there are a portion of people who just don't vote. They don't. They're not interested in it. They're skeptics. They're I've talked to people who are very, very religious, and they feel like it doesn't fit with that, you know, necessarily. There's all kinds of different personal things where there's a lot of people who just don't vote. And so if you just stick them all on a voter list and they're not going to vote, you're creating a slush fund for someone else to use to vote in their name.
Now, with what's been going on with registration, do you ever see the day where people will simply be voting on their computers or their smartphones? They won't even have to wake up in the morning and go to some polling booth or anything like that. They'll just do it from home?
There's a lot of, well, I won't say a lot. There's been a push from some industry and in some cases some of the intelligence community toward that. It's completely opaque because you have no idea if the vote that came in to the system was actually the one you keyed into your phone. I mean, that's coming up quite a bit now with online banking and the cryptocurrency like Bitcoin and so forth,
right,
where people are, you know, there's quite a big business in just, you know, being able to hack into a million phones and kind of take them over. And there's a lot at stake in some of these elections. And there's also, like you mentioned earlier, you know, does Google do this or do they not? There's this whole industry question mark. You know, we don't quite know what's happening with our information on various different technologies. And so to put yet another layer of opaqueness into the voting system is just not necessary. And it's expensive. There's much simpler ways to do it that retain the ability to check and see whether the result that they're saying is true or false. And that's the key. It's not how easy it is to vote. It's how transparent it is, because the public has to be able to know that what we're told is the result is true. Currently, that's not the case, but it could be with some pretty simple tweaks.
Well, and the confidence level, Bev, has got to be there. And I'm not so sure it's there right now.
Oh, yeah. And one of the things, too, though, is people will say, well, we have to have confidence. But actually, we have to have transparency, because the reason that you need to have transparency is not to get people confident. It's to be able to catch and deter fraud.
Right.
And
which
if you
creates
can catch
confidence.
And deter fraud, then you will in turn create confidence.
That's
but
right.
Sometimes I keep seeing, oh, we need to make it confident, and they kind of want to do this papering over of something that sounds good. But the bottom line is people are not dumb. You know, they know now, they know right now that they have no idea if those announced results are exactly right or not.
So in the election, Hillary got the popular vote. She squeezed by because she took a couple big states and got a lot of those people. And Donald Trump obviously won the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. How do you weigh that? I mean, our founding fathers, of course, set up the Electoral College because they wanted to make sure that, you know, generally states would have an equal footing somehow, and that, like in the popular vote, the big states like California and New York wouldn't always be the ones to determine who would be president. What do you think?
And the other thing is, the candidates would only campaign in a couple of locations if it was just the big ones.
Oh, well,
why would
they never go to Rhode Island or Iowa
never,
or anything?
Never, right. And there's another thing with it that people don't think about. One of the things that the founders, you know, wanted was to not have things protracted out forever and ever. Imagine if you have the national popular vote instead of Electoral College. You've got, you know, 100 million votes in the system, and you have a recount because it's close. Can you imagine how long it would take to recount not a state but the entire country?
It would probably take us into the next presidential election.
Exactly. I mean, I know that I'm a little bit opposed to saying we do something for convenience sake, but it seems like the one thing that concerns me with electoral reform is they often want to jump on the bandwagon for the latest shiny new thing without really thinking it through. And all you have to do to come up with the objection or the considerations that you and I both just did on the Electoral College is just kind of think it through. And it's like, well, how would it have to do with this and that? And, well, okay, the candidates wouldn't go any place but New York and California. And do we really want two states to control the outcome of the whole election? And do we want to spend, you know, 5 years doing a recount? So unless they're going to address the issues and think it through, then it's better to kind of stick with what we have.
Bev, in 1960, and it's well known, President Kennedy was elected president, and he was elected primarily because of the push in the Illinois-Chicago region.
Mm-hmm.
The mob helped deliver, and Joseph Kennedy, his father, helped deliver. And historians will tell you that's what happened.
Right.
Now, without technology at that time, like we have today, when they say Chicago, you know, basically bought the election for John F. Kennedy, what do they mean by that? What happened in 1960? Did they stuff the ballot boxes? What happened?
They voted some dead people quite a lot. They say, you know, that the dead are so motivated in Chicago that they rise up and vote every 4 years. But
I mean, it was a close election.
And I also heard that part of the reason Nixon didn't contest it too much is because some of the downstate folks had done the same thing for him. But I think Chicago is a special circumstance in that they've got all these local aldermen, and that's kind of that was kind of the vector for fraud, is they had all these local aldermen who were beholden to the machine. And it was their job to turn out their voters. That's what they called it. Supposedly, they're going door knocking and making sure they get a big turnout. But
that's not illegal, right?
No. Unless you actually aren't turning out the voter, you're just sticking a whole bunch of ballots
exactly.
in the box.
Exactly.
Because the truth of the matter is, you know, the way the polling system works, people all come in, you know, early in the morning and late in the afternoon, but there's these dead times when nobody's in there. And if you have control of the aldermen and the aldermen have control of who the poll workers are, then you can put whatever you want in the box.
Was everything hand tabulated in 1960?
There was a lot of lever machines. There were these big things.
Punch cards.
Not even punch cards, although there were those. I lived in Illinois in 1972, and we used punch cards. But they also had these lever machines, which they used in New York City for a long time in Philadelphia. And they're this big, huge contraption in the back. I can't even tell you. You have to have a truck to drag it around. Huh. And the things are marked, and you pull a lever, and it supposedly moves the thing to the candidate. There's also ways to mess with those, but there was levers, machines, and punch cards. So it wasn't really hand, I don't think, for the city of Chicago. It wasn't hand counted.
Nowadays, something's going on. I mean, we're into this election. You know, he's been in office. Donald Trump's been in office for 8 months. Mm-hmm. I have never seen more controversy and chaos over a president this early all my life.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just wondering, What's the next step? I mean, will there be a recall? Can you recall a president? And look, and folks, those of you who support the president, that's great, because I want him to succeed because we succeed. We're talking about possibilities.
Right.
And the possibilities are that they could impeach him. Can they recall him? Can they say, look, let's nullify the election? This is not working. I mean, there are some who actually want to legally get his mental fitness checked.
I know. I mean, you've got a couple things in play that are making this even more controversial. One is, regardless of policy, there's a lot of people who really don't like his style, have a visceral reaction to his style, and just
regardless of what he does.
He could be doing anything. And then there's also the fact that he's doing a lot of things that go against the grain of what the establishment is. And we know that the established Congress and so forth isn't working all that great.
Their popularity is lower than his.
Yeah, and so you do have a lot of things going toward people saying, well, hey, you know, let's get this guy out. I looked that up because I wondered if there is such a thing, because you hear it now and then. They recalled the governor of California, in fact, and that's how Arnold Schwarzenegger became governor.
Yeah, that's right.
They recalled Gray Davis. But elections are held state by state by state. If it's a federal election, it has to match up with the federal election regulations, but they don't, as far as I could find, have any federal recall mechanism.
I don't know. It's weird. Now, with all this, what's happening technologically with these electronic voting boxes? What's the next election going to be?
Oh, you know, there's some really good news, I think. There's some things coming down the pike that if citizens sort of put their shoulder to the wall, I think they're pretty achievable for us to make a huge difference. One of the things, I have a little article on my website called The Brakey Method, B-R-A-K-E-Y, because this one activist in Arizona really has been doing great litigation to get this happening. Basically, all these, you need a paper ballot. Forget about these invisible vapor things. That's no good. You can never really check it. But if you have a paper ballot, it goes through an automatic scanning machine, and the new scanning machines all take a picture of every ballot. Now, that's just a computer file, and granted, it can be manipulated. It's kind of complicated to do it, but, you know, you can't do it too easily, but it can be done. But if you have you know how when you can deposit a check in an automatic ATM machine. It stamps a number on it when it's deposited.
Right.
And scans it. You can get a picture of it right then and there.
That's right.
And if a number is stamped by the machine when it scans that ballot and it takes a picture, and then there's going to be that matching number on the ballot, and if you have the public, in most states this is the case, the public can go and inspect the actual ballots. Just like you can go and inspect the deeds, it's a public record.
But who in the heck, Bev, is going to go and check all those?
Oh, you know, out? You'd be surprised.
Really?
There's these folks that do it every time in the states that you know, and especially if it's controversial. So let's suppose you have all these photographs of ballots. Madison, Wisconsin is in a county called Dane County, Wisconsin. Their elections registrar said, you know what, I'm going to put all those on the web. I mean, they don't have your name on them or anything. You know, it's just all the ballots. So everybody could see them right away. And they could get all of them and do whatever you want with them. They can make their own little audit and say, I'm going to take my little sample of this, 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 and this, and then I'm going to go to my elections office and I'm going to have them pull the ballot with the same number and make sure that the ballot matches my thing. If you do that, you're sort of, there's a term for it, crowdsourcing, where you're just basically saying anybody can jump in and audit anything, right? It doesn't cost really anything to the government. That's what I love about it. The machines are already set up to do it. It's just that they're not telling anybody. And the reason I call it the Brakey Method is because this citizen in Arizona, John Brakey, decided, well, I'm going to ask for those. And so he did. And you know what they said? They said, oh, yes, they take a picture of every ballot, but we destroy those immediately.
All right. If you were consulting a candidate, mm-hmm. and your job was to teach them technology and how to deal with it and how to work it, as another facet of the campaign.
Right.
What would you be telling the next presidential candidates with what you know about black box voting?
Yeah. Well, one thing that makes it not a simple answer is because every state has really big differences in how they do things.
Okay.
So we have west of the Mississippi, we've got a huge amount of vote by mail, even in the states that, like Oregon is 100% vote by mail, so is Washington. California and Arizona, a lot of people don't realize this, are about 80% vote by mail. So for those kinds of states, you have got to teach the candidate what the specific things to look for with a vote by mail system are, because that's where most of the ballots are going to come in.
Wow.
In a lot of the eastern states, they still have the paperless touchscreens, which are just super fun. You know, you can do things and no one can ever prove anything.
Mm-hmm.
And with a lot of the other states that have paper ballots, Florida's one. That's a more complicated answer. But Kansas, let's say, has some paper ballots. They've forbidden by law anybody from ever looking at the paper ballot, even in a recount. So you have to first go, what's my terrain and which states am I most needing to deal with? And then, I have answers for the candidates depending on the type of system. I'll tell you what, this vote by mail, I'm learning a lot about it, and it's a scary bit of business.
Well, it's important for, I think, candidates of the future to understand how it works, or at least their campaign people.
Exactly. And some of them were, you know, there was in the presidential primary for the Democratic Party, there was an outlier candidate named Rocky De La Fuente. And he did just exactly that. He said, teach me everything. And then he went ahead and he asked me what to do, and I suggested that we get a public records request into California that had him account for all of this one category of ballots. They had about 20% of all their ballots that were very iffy in the primary. And they said, oh, we can't account for those at all. Well, that was an important thing to learn. And he also found some real anomalies with candidates to get on the ballot have to get a certain number of signatures sometimes, and there's some issues with that. And so there are things candidates can do, and they have special standing to get a lot of the information, but he had the right idea. Let me go audit this thing. Let me go see what I can find out. Now, what he found out was he wasn't allowed to audit it, but that's useful because you have citizens in various states now. Amazing, great litigations going on in different states. And that's the thrust of it. It's not my candidate should have won. It's can I audit this thing or not? If I can't, I want the right to, and I'm going to court for it. And there must be at least 5 lawsuits on that in various states that are really getting some traction.
There are a lot of election lawsuits out there, aren't there?
Well, most of the election lawsuits have to do with a candidate who thinks he should have won.
Yeah.
And I kind of steer clear of those because I kind of size up whether the candidate actually wants the system to get better or he just wants to win.
Well, you know, you had mentioned Nixon, and truth be known, he decided not to challenge the election, and he could have because it was so darn close.
Totally. Yes.
He said it wouldn't be good for the country. And
right.
So he just, you know, he just took it like a champ and walked away.
Yeah, and I think Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, challenged 3 states for a recount. She
mm-hmm.
probably should have asked for an audit, not a recount, because of some technical reasons. But
right.
Because it wasn't that she thought she could win. But a recount is basically, I think I should be able to win if you recount them, right? An audit or a contest, it gets into, was the count actually correct, regardless of who won.
Exactly.
But, they just went after her, though. They was like, how dare she try to challenge the system, you know.
And screw everything up.
And you need to be able to see whether you're a candidate or a citizen. If you want to know, it's just like if you want to know how the government is spending your money, you can go down and you can request the budget, and you can even see every payment and everybody they paid money to.
That's a good point.
Your right under freedom of information law. Same thing, it should be the same thing with elections, that you can go down and you can get the basic information. You can perform your own audit of whatever little portion of the election you want.
Bev, we're going to take this break at the top of the hour. We're coming back to talk more and take calls with you next.